one big difference between this recession and all previous recessions is that the Affordable Care Act is there as a safety net for people losing their job-based health insurance.
Hi, I'm Jim Doyle, President of Business Forward, and you're listening to the Business Forward podcast. Business Forward helps local business leaders fix Washington by bringing Washington to them. Subscribe to our podcast to hear conversations with policy experts, elected officials, and business leaders about important issues like climate action and affordable health care. In this episode, we hosted a briefing with Larry Levitt, who is the Executive Vice President of Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Levitt discussed how COVID-19-related layoffs have led to a loss of employer-sponsored insurance for millions of Americans. He discussed coverage options that exist for the recently uninsured, including those through the ACA marketplace and through Medicaid. He also discussed what Medicaid expansion in remaining 13 states might look like. We hope you enjoyed the conversation.
Larry, thank you very much for joining. Could you just kick it off by explaining how COVID-19 has affected the healthcare system?
I can. Thanks, Jim, for having me. And as you said, we are in a very terrible time. We're facing what is probably the most uncertain and disruptive time for the healthcare system, literally ever. You know, we are in the midst of a pandemic of historic proportions. We have seen limits on access to care for conditions other than COVID-19 as healthcare systems try to create capacity to deal with the surge of COVID-19 cases and people, patients, being hesitant to go to the doctor or hospital for care they may need. And this has produced odd results. I mean, for example, just yesterday, UnitedHealthcare, largest insurance company in the country, reported quarterly operating earnings of $9 billion because so few people are using healthcare. And then finally, we're facing an economic crisis where tens of millions of people have lost their jobs and in many cases, potentially their health insurance as well. You know, one big difference between this recession and all previous recessions is that the Affordable Care Act is there as a safety net for people losing their job-based health insurance. An important safety net, but also an imperfect one, as I'll talk about. I want to start by reviewing what we do and don't know about what's happening to health insurance coverage right now. Unlike economic statistics like unemployment or inflation, there's no real-time data for the number of people uninsured. We have to look at simulation models and read tea leaves to try to assess what's happening. Early on in the crisis, we projected that 27 million people could lose their health insurance after losing jobs based on the job loss figures coming out from the federal government. And that's certainly an eye-popping and very scary number. Significantly, we also estimated that 79% of people losing their jobs and health insurance would be eligible for help under the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid, which is a safety net that never before existed. Now, fortunately, 27 million people have not lost their health insurance, at least not yet. Anecdotally, many employers have maintained health benefits for furloughed or laid off workers in the hopes that they can bring those workers back to their jobs soon. But that won't last forever. And if unemployment remains high, we will see massive losses in health insurance coverage. Right now, my best guess, looking at models and surveys, is that a few million more people are uninsured so far. That maybe doesn't sound so bad, particularly relative to some of those early scary numbers, but it's comparable, roughly comparable, to what happened during the Great Recession. So certainly quite catastrophic. Now, if four out of five people, as we estimated, losing health insurance are eligible for help under the ACA and Medicaid, you know, what's the problem? Well, one problem is that one out of five are not eligible for help and will face really difficult problems affording health care without insurance coverage in the middle of a pandemic. Another big problem going forward is that 13 states have not expanded Medicaid eligibility under the Affordable Care Act. In those states, eligibility levels for parents are generally quite low, and adults without children are not eligible for coverage at all, as was the case in all states before the ACA passed. And since eligibility for premium subsidies in the ACA insurance exchanges start at the poverty level, many poor uninsured people in these states not expanding Medicaid are caught in something of a dead zone known as the coverage gap. Now, note that the federal government covers 90% of the cost for the Medicaid expansion under the ACA. So while there is a fiscal element to the decision of whether to expand, because states do still have to cover that
that 10% of the cost, there's also an ideological and symbolic component tied to this being Obamacare and more conservative states being resistant to signing on. Just recently, Oklahoma voters approved a ballot initiative to expand Medicaid over the objections of the political leadership. Missouri will also be voting on a ballot initiative this fall, and the pandemic and economic crisis could certainly spur some other states to expand Medicaid. For all states, more people losing private insurance means more people signing up for Medicaid, which is a good thing, but it also results in a hit on state budgets. The Families First Relief Act, passed by Congress, increased federal matching payments for Medicaid by the federal government by 6.2 percentage points, but ultimately that's likely not enough to offset increased Medicaid costs for states and the huge tax revenue declines from the economic crisis. There are also affordability concerns for individuals, even with the help that the ACA provides. Medicaid, where it's available, is typically free for people who are eligible. However, in the ACA exchange plans, even with federal subsidies, those plans can feel unaffordable, including substantial deductibles that patients will face. The Trump administration efforts to undermine the ACA could also hinder efforts to cover people. The Trump administration reduced outreach under the ACA by 90% and reduced grants to navigators who help people enroll by 84%. So many people may get lost in the shuffle, not knowing options that are available to them. The administration also declined to reopen the ACA enrollment period during the crisis. People losing their employer health coverage get a special enrollment period, meaning they can still sign up, but those already uninsured can't sign up now because the enrollment period is closed. One thing the Trump administration has done is expand the availability of so-called short-term plans, which do not follow the ACA's rules. These policies have much lower premiums than ACA plans, but that's because they don't cover people with pre-existing conditions and often exclude or limit benefits like maternity care, drugs, and mental health and substance abuse. So many would be turned away by these plans if they do lose their employer-based health insurance, and they certainly carry risks if you get sick. Now, remarkably, in the midst of this double whammy of a public health and economic crisis, there's been surprisingly little discussion in Washington about how to prevent people from becoming uninsured. One idea that has emerged with substantial support from the healthcare industry, labor groups, and the business community is to provide a full subsidy or near full subsidy for COBRA continuation coverage for people who lose jobs. You know, I think it's the simplest and easiest way to ensure people losing their jobs maintain health coverage. And in the middle of a pandemic, it ensures families can maintain their same insurance policy and same relationships with doctors. The downside is it's very expensive to subsidize COBRA 100% for everyone who's unemployed. Family coverage, as many business owners know, carry premiums of over $20,000 a year on average. So subsidizing that coverage for everyone would be quite costly. And quite costly for patients, too. Even if the premium is subsidized fully, deductibles average around $1,600 per person. That can be a challenge for people when they're working, but an even bigger challenge when they're unemployed and have lost income. There are also ideas out there to build on the ACA and create a more seamless safety net. Joe Biden's health plan revolves around the idea of a public option, a Medicare-like plan available to anyone, including workers with job-based insurance they view as unaffordable. His plan also enhances the ACA's premium assistance, extending it to some middle-class people who are not now eligible. The public option and increased subsidies are targeted at expanding coverage. They make coverage more affordable, and low-income uninsured people, including in states that have not expanded Medicaid, would be enrolled automatically at no cost. But I think the public option also is a significant mechanism for cost control. Private insurance plans pay hospitals roughly double what Medicare pays, so a public option carries the potential to reduce prices and healthcare costs overall. As with any reform plan, Biden's plan comes with significant trade-offs and political challenges. It would certainly increase federal spending, requiring tax increases to offset that cost, and the healthcare industry would bitterly oppose the idea of a public option and restraints on hospital and physician prices. Now, swirling in the background of all this is a lawsuit before the Supreme Court where state Republican attorneys general and the Trump administration are seeking to overturn the entire ACA. The court won't issue a decision in this case until after the election, but you can be sure it will be a big issue in the campaign. President Trump has not put out a plan to replace the ACA, including protections for people with pre-existing conditions or the Medicaid expansion and insurance exchanges that cover over 20 million people combined. You know, the debate over the future of the ACA, which has been going on for more than a decade from the moment the law passed, will continue to shape the healthcare system. Certainly, if the Supreme Court overturns the ACA, there would be immediate chaos in the healthcare system and political chaos as well, as policymakers scramble to figure out what would be put in its place. Meanwhile, the pandemic and economic crisis, I think, could force some rethinking of our primarily employer-based health insurance system. They'll shine a spotlight on the challenges faced by people who lose their jobs and their insurance, especially in those 13 states that have not expanded Medicaid. And it will also highlight how we are not only the only developed country without universal coverage, but also a country that pays the highest prices for healthcare that we do get in the world. There are big economic and political barriers to solving these problems, but I think also now a greater urgency to do so. So I look forward to hearing your questions and continuing the discussion.
So Larry, we've got a range of questions, some on the policy end and others from business owners who have very specific questions about their businesses. Let's start with the policy and then we can go to the specifics. Frank Klimko, Best Week Insurance News from Clifton, Virginia asks, CMS has noted a large number of consumers moving to the ACA exchanges with the pandemic. Will they stay?
And there has been a big increase in people who have enrolled under the so-called special enrollment period for people who lose their employer-based health insurance. You know, it's still just a fraction of the number of people who have likely lost their employer-based health insurance. So I think we are still moving backwards. But there are people who are finding that coverage and people who are finding Medicaid as well. You know, the experience is that once people do enroll in ACA exchange coverage, that it's generally pretty stable, that there are mechanisms to automatically renew people into coverage from year to year. You know, certainly some people face affordability concerns with the high premiums even after federal subsidies, but generally people stick with the coverage once they get it.
And one point just for listeners is we know that the numbers are lower than they will be because some employers are trying to hang on. But you've also noted that eligibility for Medicaid and ACA subsidies will also increase when people's unemployment insurance. So you expect the big jump sometime in early 2021, sounds like.
That's right. And there's a lot of uncertainty ahead. I mean, we just don't know how long employers are going to be able to hang on to providing health benefits for their workers. But there are, you know, some big implications from when unemployment benefits expire. And in fact, the $600 per week federal supplement expires very shortly at the end of July. And that could have the perverse effect of pushing more people into the Medicaid coverage gap in those states that have not expanded Medicaid because their incomes would fall below poverty and they would qualify for nothing.
Well, that actually leads to the next question. We've got a number of people have asked it. Why are these governors refusing to expand Medicaid?
Well, I think, you know, there is a fiscal element to it. I mean, the federal government subsidizes 90% of the cost of the Medicaid expansion, but 10% of the cost is still a tough nut to crack for some states, and even more so now as state revenues are plummeting as a result of the crisis. But, you know, there is still a strong ideological component here. I mean, from the very start, once the Supreme Court ruled the Medicaid expansion voluntary, it was framed as a decision for governors as to whether they, you know, supported Obamacare or opposed Obamacare. Even over a decade past when the law was enacted, that ideological symbolism still persists. There are important debates in these states about expanding Medicaid, these remaining 13 states, and you know, in many cases, the hospital industry is active because they certainly have a big stake in expanding coverage and the business community as well. I mean, particularly businesses that employ a lot of low-wage workers, Medicaid can be a, you know, significant source of coverage for their employees.
The New England Journal of Medicine has published a report that showed that for states that did expand Medicaid, their spending, it evened out in the end. And logic seems to suggest that if you're getting 90 cents of spending support from the federal government that, you know, in exchange for your spending an additional 10 cents, the 90 cents on the dollar that you're getting is saving you money that you'd be spending anyway, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, economically, it's a phenomenal deal for states. I mean, you spend 10 cents on the dollar and get the other 90 cents in federal money. And frankly, your taxes are supporting that 90 cents that's going to other states already. And there are a number of analyses that have shown that not only is it good for state economies, but it can even be good for state budgets, that the higher revenues and the lower costs in other state programs can offset that 10% cost for expanding Medicaid.
There, we have a couple questions about enrollment. Yeah, you mentioned that the Trump administration had cut funding. So we've got a question from Bianca in New York City. Why have the health enrollment periods not been extended? And we've also got a question from Marjorie Arneva-Mosley from HRSE Arrays from Dayton, Ohio asks, will there be like-minded organizations assisting enrollment efforts with advertising, TV, radio, and telephones? So if you could just talk a little bit more about that. Number one, the administration's justification for the cuts, and number two, whether you think eventually they might change.
Well, you know, I certainly can't speak for the White House, but you know, the administration justified the cuts in outreach and enrollment assistance by saying that there was lack of evidence that, that the outreach really worked. You know, others counter that view. Yeah, I think when the cuts happened, you know, it was part of a overall effort by the Trump administration, which bitterly opposed the ACA and tried to repeal it to undermine the law. Groups have stepped in. Nonprofit groups with philanthropic funding have stepped in a number of states to pick up some of the slack. Private insurance brokers and insurers themselves have also provided assistance and done outreach. But I think it doesn't replace what the federal government had done previously. And I think, you know, it's at a time like this where we could really see the effects of that lack of outreach. You know, one would expect a massive campaign right now to help people losing their jobs understand what benefits are available to them, and that's simply not happening.
Maria Elena Yippies from Los Angeles, California asks, how has the ACA helped individuals who have private insurance?
Yeah, there were, I mean, a main target of the ACA was people who were uninsured, who lacked coverage. But a big component of the ACA was to shore up private insurance and provide protections that didn't exist before. So, for example, you know, in all private insurance plans, the ACA prohibited lifetime and annual caps on coverage. It was not uncommon to have a cap of $1 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but if you get severely ill, you could hit that cap and your coverage would start. The ACA also required coverage of preventive services with no out-of-pocket cost for patients, you know, everything from mammograms to colonoscopies to flu shots to contraception, which the Supreme Court recently allowed the Trump administration to limit. And I think really importantly, the ACA provided guarantees of protections for people with pre-existing conditions. You know, many people who have coverage through an employer already had those protections as long as they maintain that coverage consistently. But, you know, 27% of adults have a pre-existing condition that would have led to a denial of insurance if they had lost that employer-based insurance and were forced to buy it on their own.
The majority of business leaders in our network own their own small businesses. And one of the things we've read about the ACA is that it also gave the small businesses more bargaining power. They were at a disadvantage vis-a-vis larger companies. Could you explain that dynamic?
Yeah, and I think the ACA, frankly, didn't go far enough in helping small businesses get on equal footing with larger employers. You know, the ACA did create what was known as the shop exchange. It was sort of a purchasing co-op for small businesses, which never, I think, worked as well as hoped. But, you know, many of the insurance rules that apply to individuals buying coverage also apply to small businesses. So, you know, coverage has to provide the 10 essential benefit categories. It has to guarantee coverage regardless of pre-existing conditions of the small businesses workers and limited premiums due to age and prohibited premium variation due to gender and the health of the workforce. You know, small businesses have never been in much of a position to really, negotiate with insurance companies. So these kind of limits on the premium increases that a small business could face if one worker got sick provide some protections for small businesses that a larger pool like a big company already had.
We've got a question from Joy Bergfalk, Executive Director of Project Empower Coffee Connection in Rochester, New York, that relates to the challenge of paying employees so much that they don't qualify for subsidies. I'll read it. I think it probably applies to a lot of businesses in our network, even ones who aren't nonprofits. As a small nonprofit, we cannot afford to buy health insurance, but one of our board members does Medicaid, OCA, and disability work, so we have used the best options possible. If we pay our employees more, they are knocked out of the OCA, thus keeping them in poverty. How can we expand our business and increase pay without hurting our employees?
It's one of the features of the U.S. healthcare system where we rely on the tie between employment and health insurance and have this kind of patchwork for those who don't have coverage or where small businesses can't afford to provide coverage. You know, and there was, I think, one of the biggest gaps created when the ACA passed was the inadequacy of the subsidies to truly make coverage affordable for people. You know, and that was true for lower income people where the subsidies might not be enough to really make coverage affordable, but, you know, very much for middle class people above the eligibility threshold for the subsidies who, you know, could face a big jump in premiums, a severe cliff if they got a salary increase. You know, and there was a big debate when the ACA passed about, you know, how generous to make these subsidies and then how much that would cost. And I think there was a strong effort to keep the overall 10-year federal cost under $1 trillion, and that led to lower subsidies that may have been necessary to truly make insurance affordable. And, you know, that's a continuing debate. And I think, a big part of the plan the Democrats in the House recently passed and a big part of Joe Biden's plan is to enhance those subsidies, both for lower income people and extend them to people who are middle class who currently face that cliff.
Mickey Judkins from Eau Claire, Wisconsin asks, this is an important reminder to the business community of the vast savings in employee benefits since adoption of the ACA. Business leaders need to support the ACA and the move to improve it by Joe Biden with the addition of a public option. One huge challenge is the medical community is afraid of low reimbursement rates for these patients. How do we structure the public option so it financially works for doctors and hospitals?
I think that will be the biggest debate surrounding the public option if Joe Biden is elected. You know, it's much less disruptive than, for example, a Medicare for All plan that would put everyone into a government-sponsored public plan. But still, it's viewed by the healthcare industry as the camel's nose under the tent of government regulation of prices. And, I think the debate will revolve around a balance, of creating a public option that offers more affordable insurance and lower prices and one that is sustainable for doctors and hospitals and not too disruptive. Currently, private insurers pay hospitals roughly double what Medicare pays, and they pay doctors, upwards of 50% more than Medicare. So I think the political debate will revolve around, finding some number that provides more affordable coverage but doesn't disrupt the finances of healthcare providers too severely.
You mentioned that President Trump hasn't submitted a plan to replace the ACA if the suit succeeds. Essentially, the plan, in broadest strokes, is the federal government would change the spending to block grants, and the expectation is that states would be better able to control health care costs and deliver a good service than the federal governments because presumably they're just closer to the patients and closer to the hospitals. The idea of the government capping spending puts the risks on the states. And during the pandemic, that risk is increased substantially because you have more people going on public subsidized health care. You've got rising cost of care for people who are sick, and the cost of whatever treatment or vaccines might come along could be substantial. So do you see the pandemic as diminishing states' willingness to take this deal? And if it's not diminishing their willingness, should it?
Great question. The I said that President Trump has not put out a plan to replace the ACA if it were overturned by the Supreme Court, like he's asking. But it's not like we don't have any clues to what a replacement plan from President Trump might look like. In the past, in congressional debates and in his budgets, President Trump has endorsed the idea of converting not only the ACA, but also the entire Medicaid program into a block grant to states, you know, a fixed sum of money for each state, and as you said, putting the risk on states. President Trump has also issued guidelines permitting states to convert portions of their Medicaid programs on a voluntary basis into something that looks like a block grant. You know, I think the risk of a block grant has always been that a state would face unforeseen costs from some kind of health shock or an economic crisis. And that's exactly what we are in right now. So I think the pandemic and the resulting economic crisis provides a very tangible illustration of the kind of risks states would take under a block grant. And I would definitely expect the current environment to diminish states' enthusiasm for taking on that kind of risk.
A few weeks ago, Zeke and Rahm Emanuel published an op-ed in the New York Times that described a grand bargain whereby the federal government would pick up the rest of the Medicaid tab in exchange for states spending the savings on education and infrastructure as a way to sort of the opposite take from the block grant program. Is something like that viable, and do you think something like this could actually pass?
Any kind of grand fiscal bargain like that carries, the potential for winners and losers across states, and that always makes it very difficult politically to pass an approach like that. But I think with the passage of the ACA, we have moved towards greater uniformity in healthcare protections across states, but particularly with the Supreme Court's decision to make the Medicaid expansion voluntary, there are still big disparities across states in the health coverage and protections that people have. And, there's always an argument that states should have greater control over their healthcare systems because those systems and conditions vary so much from state to state. But, I think we are gradually moving towards a system where there are certain minimum guarantees available everywhere, like federalizing Medicaid would provide. And there are elements of Biden's plan that would, I think, move in that direction as well. For example, the public option would automatically enroll all low-income uninsured people, including those in states that have not expanded Medicaid. So that would shift more of the balance to the federal government. So I'm generally skeptical of kind of grand fiscal bargains because, they're so tricky politically, but kind of moving in the general direction of providing uniform guarantees does certainly have some appeal.
Larry, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to keeping in touch because we know that the situation is going to keep evolving. So thank you very much for your time.
Oh, anytime. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. For more information on Business Forward programming, visit businessfwd.org. The Business Forward podcast is a production of Business Forward, hosted by me, Jim Doyle, and Ed Meyer. Produced and engineered by Alexi Lippman and Alex Pastanen. Special thanks to our Director of Programming, Jana Platt. Thanks for listening. See you next time.